From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made when a millionaire CEO changed his mind on President Donald Trump. Back in 2016, Patrick Byrne was one of Trump's most consistent critics. Byrne identifies as a libertarian, and he was no fan of Hillary Clinton. But the founder of Overstock.com had the following to say about Trump then, quote, "I don't consider Donald Trump a businessman. He inherited $300 million and he ran it down to zero, went bankrupt, shafted bondholders. He's a fake capitalist and a fake businessman," end quote. Well, this week, talking to Reason magazine, Byrne says Donald Trump's policies have been better than he expected. Byrne says that Trump is dismantling the administrative state, deregulating the economy in powerful ways. Byrne believes that Trump has sparked progress on such issues as tax reform, criminal justice reform, and school choice. Well, is that enough for conservatives who might have been on the fence about Trump? And it matters. An average of recent polling finds that Trump's approval rating is at 42%, disapproval rating at 52%. Pretty dangerous territory for a president who wants to be reelected. Earlier this week, we hosted a panel of Democrats talking about how they hope to win in 2020, not just the presidential level, but all levels. And today we welcome a panel of Republicans to have the same conversation from their perspective, looking ahead to 2020. Our guests in studio, glad to have, for the first time since his elevation to the position, the chair of the Monroe County Republican Party. That's Bill Napier. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Paul Simonelli of Counsel to the Wolford Law Firm, among other titles in our... I feel like every time I see you, it's a different title. Radio host.
A little bit of everything.
Thank you, Paul. Mark Cassini is former Gatestown supervisor, and he is the CAO at American Rock Salt. And Mark, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
All right. So I want to start with Bill just because it's the first time we've had a chance to sit down here since the change in position. Tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing now as the leader of the Monroe County Republican Party. Technically temporary, but pretty soon that's probably going to be made permanent.
Correct. Well, we've been focused primarily on the primary for the Independence Party that occurred on Tuesday night. We're very happy with the results. The county executive, Cheryl Donolfo, prevailed in her challenge that she had for that race. And a lot of what we're going to be working on going forward is going to be in parallel with the message that the new state party chair, Nick Langworthy, has started, which is to rebuild, retool, and revitalize the party.
Okay, and one interesting thing I was looking at, Bill, is that there's a number that I was looking at from the Board of Elections that I think in some ways is in your favor, and in other ways might be a red flag, which is that the Republican Party is pretty old compared to Democrats. 18 to 34-year-olds, Democrats have roughly twice the number of the percentage of Democrats in that category versus Republicans, and it's the flip side over the age of 65. Now, on the good side, those voters vote. They show up. They're very reliable. But the party is getting older. Do you view that as a concern or something to address?
It's something that we definitely have to address, and I think that that's one of the things that Nick has on his agenda and something that we're going to participate on. It's not just that number that's troubling. It's the overall growth of registered Democrats throughout the state versus Republicans. And they are registering new members into that party at a significant rate. And the new registrations of Republicans in New York State is anemic in comparison. And that needs to be turned around.
How are you going to do that?
Well, we've got a convention coming up here over the weekend and be able to sit down with Nick and talk about that. There's, you know, we need to be more engaged with people throughout the community on a daily basis. We need to get out of our headquarters operations and get out and work with our committees, help them be able to do outreach into their neighborhoods, introduce people to their candidates, the issues that are most important in their towns, their villages, and throughout the county, and message exactly what Republican government has done for them in our community, which I'm quite proud of, and I think when looking back at it, most of the voters in this community have felt that way. That's why they've returned Republicans like Mark as supervisor and Gates time and time again, our county executive, our district attorney. Republicans do very well in the ballot box and on local races.
I think sometimes the media probably overinflates the idea that a presidential candidate or a president can impact sort of the youth vote within the party, though there's probably some correlation. I mean, Democrats didn't turn out that many new young voters with John Kerry as a candidate in 2004. They did very well with Barack Obama. How do you view the impact of the presidency right now and Donald Trump in terms of convincing young people to sign up for the party? Is it helpful or hurtful?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how Donald Trump necessarily affects that. I've been paying attention to it a little bit more on the other side of the aisle. You know, 4 years ago, it was the Bernie Sanders factor and those who were energized there. That was a very youthful organization and a youthful group of Democrats that came out to support him in the primaries. I don't believe that they ended up performing as well as anticipated when it came to the general election. So the Democrats have struggled to be able to convert, whether it was, you know, years ago it was Rock the Vote on MTV in an attempt to outreach to young voters, or, you know, they've had candidates that have energized and excited younger voters. But younger voters remain a challenge for both parties, and getting them to actually perform and come out and vote in November. So I don't think that it's a specific issue with Republicans or Democrats. They both have it.
But do you see an opening, given the fact that you're certainly right, and when you look at Bernie Sanders supporters, they skew younger, and there was a lot of anger over what they perceived as mistreatment of Bernie Sanders during the primary process for 2016. They felt the process was essentially gamed to favor Hillary Clinton, fair or not. And some sat out. I mean, there wasn't nearly as much crossover as sometimes the media says of Sanders voters to Trump voters. There's some. But do you feel that that was an opening for your party, given that maybe that disenfranchisement and that feeling?
Well, I don't think that it was in the cards to think that you were going to be able to attract a Sanders voter to come over and be a supporter on the Republican Party. What I was speaking more to is that Democrats, that these voters tend to be very loyal to the candidate, that party is less important to them. So when Sanders didn't get the nomination, whether it was because of a manipulation that was going on in the primary process and they felt it was rigged against him, or whatever the case may be, when he wasn't on the ballot later on, they weren't Democrats necessarily, first and foremost. They were Bernie Sanders supporters. And I think if you look at the 20-plus candidates that are in the field now for Democrats, they're going to have that challenge to face come November, too, that those who are Elizabeth Warren supporters, if she's not the candidate, they will probably shed some of those people because they are devoted and they're loyal supporters to Elizabeth Warren. They're going to have to spend some time and outreach to sit there and bring those people to whoever their nominee is. And for the most part, you know, with the example of Bernie Sanders, that didn't necessarily take place 4 years ago.
So let me ask you, all three of our guests, if they identify at least with some of the sentiment, as I expressed in the introduction, of someone like Patrick Byrne, who, you know, was a pretty strong Trump critic and now tells Reason. A lot of people thought he was going to run for the Libertarian nomination. He says he's not. He's much more satisfied with this administration than he thought he would be on economic policy. Bill, do you think this president is doing a good job?
I think that he's doing a good job on many important issues that are meaningful to voters and to Americans. The economy is strong, unemployment's low, the Fed's poised to cut interest rates again. He has, you know, Wall Street is performing well. A lot of those things are meaningful to voters, and there's a tax cut that took place. These are things that I think people look at, and they're very pleased with what
GDP
the president
is at a level that it hasn't been at in a decade or so.
Right. And so. The show that you had the other day, that one of the questions was, you know, sort of how do you win, and what is a predictor, or sort of what do you think the prospect is for your candidate, whether that show was Democrats, this is going to be Donald Trump.
Yeah.
It's generally been difficult to unseat incumbents that are in the White House. You know, Carter and Bush are the exception. But one of the most difficult things to overcome is when the economy is roaring, and usually 3% is the benchmark. If it's higher at that level or higher, it's virtually impossible to unseat
GDP.
A president. Correct.
Yeah. I think the difference – well, hold on. We'll get back to that point on the economy in just a second. No. I don't think that's wonky at all, man. That's just history. It is very hard to win, and we will get to, as the hour goes on, whether our guests also agree with the sentiment expressed by one of the guests earlier this week, which is that the election is really seven states. It's not popular vote. It's not 50 states. It's a small group of states that Donald Trump did very well in. So we'll get back to that in just a second. How do you think this president's doing, Mark?
I think he's doing very well for the reasons that Bill has talked about. I think he, at times, is divisive. That's pretty obvious. Sometimes he says things that upset people, including me. But overall, the economy is doing very well. Unemployment, as Bill had indicated and I had indicated, the GDP is doing extremely well. It's performing at a level we haven't seen in many, many years. The reason I supported Donald Trump, and I was the first to say I did not like the two choices that we had, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, but the reason I supported Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton is because I wanted somebody who would move the economy forward. That was the biggest issue that we faced. And it'd be pretty tough to argue from anybody that that hasn't happened.
We'll get back to that. Paul Simonelli, is he doing a good job?
That's, I would say on some of the policy things, I'm very satisfied with what he's doing. But if I can just draw maybe some distinction with that. In states like New York, California, Michigan, Illinois, it doesn't translate because even though there's been a tax cut, we don't feel it here. We have highest property taxes. We have the most regulation. We have a whole slew of things that have happened in this last legislative session in the state that's going to make it much more expensive. So what Donald Trump is saying publicly is absolutely true about the economy, but also what AOC is saying from a New York City perspective, if you're making $13 an hour in New York City and you have to live through all this regulation and it costs you $9 to go across a bridge and it costs you $8 every time you want to ride public transportation, your life isn't much better off. So the blue states, I'll call them the blue states, have built into them, even though the economy is doing much better, and we lost some tax incentives here in New York State that are devastating for small business owners. But we're still doing, you know, everyone's doing better. But I think for the average person, red state people are doing much better because of less regulation, less control, and other things than we have in blue states. So I think Bill's got a gigantic challenge to try to translate the success that we see in the red states to New York State.
But how do you think, like, Kansas is doing, for example? Longtime red state. It's turning bluer. We're seeing actual Democrats win in places in Kansas they never won before. If your formulation is correct, why is Kansas starting to turn?
Well, here's what I'll say. I think Bill nailed it also when he said it's not about party anymore. It absolutely is not. This generation, I mean, I can give you a little history lesson, but you know, we can go back to the third Super Bowl. You know, you look at the two quarterbacks. You had Joe Namath and you had Johnny Unitas. Johnny Unitas was a team guy, had a brush cut. Joe Namath wore a mink coat to the stadium. You know, it was very individualistic.
My man Joe. I'm a Jets fan. Go ahead.
All right. So, but that was really where you saw a paradigm shift where the team became less important than the individual. Today, the younger generation, they're very focused on individual rather than the relationship of belonging to a team. So the party association is less important than the individual that you're voting for. And I think that what you may see some of that happen, just like we're seeing some of that happen in our own community in places where, you know, you never saw a Democrat win before. You might see a Democrat slip into a town board or something. I think people are looking at the individual.
But this is going to be a unique election season. Here's why. Because we now have very binary choices. It's either this or it's that. You're either going to have more government control over our economy, and that's what the leaders in the Democrat Party are pushing, socialism, and control over every aspect of it, or you're going to have economic and personal freedom through capitalism. That's the way this party should frame the argument, because, quite frankly, that is the argument that is going to be made this coming election.
Well, to be clear, most of the Democrats running are capitalists. They want a lot more regulation of the economy than many of the Republicans.
Wait. I listened to the debate last night, and what I heard was not capitalism, okay? In fact, one of the leading contenders, Bernie Sanders, and one of his leaders in the Congress is talking about what? Socialism.
Yeah, democratic socialism. I agree with that. I agree that there are some candidates who are anti-capitalism, and then there are some who are for regulated capitalism.
Well, let's go right at it. If you're telling me controlling government-controlled health care, government-controlled
education
at the college level, government-controlled housing, government-controlled subsidies for food.
All of those things exist already. All of those things exist already.
Not to the level they're talking about.
Socialism really is the means of production. The state owning the means of production.
In fact, last night, if I heard correctly, correct me if I'm wrong,
yeah.
They not only said that, they went one step further. They said, not only do we want to pay for all those things, we want to now pay for people who are here in the country illegally. We want to pay for their health care lifetime. We've got 28.5 million people, 28.5 million people that don't have health insurance, and we're going to pay for people from another country that are coming in here illegally? I that's a very binary choice. Might people, some people, and there are Democrats that will say, absolutely, that's the right thing to do. But I guarantee that's a binary choice. Either you support that or you don't. I don't.
I don't want to argue like means of production and wonky what is socialism, what is not. Clearly, Democrats want more regulation, and some Democrats want less of that, and some want all of that. And it's sort of a sliding scale with 20 candidates. It's a fascinating mix of 20 candidates.
Well,
right,
the leading candidates are pretty clear.
Yes, I was. Well, Joe Biden is a world apart from Elizabeth Warren.
I'm not sure where Joe Biden is.
Well, Joe Biden was part of a White House.
Probably not sure either.
Joe Biden was part of a White House that raised the top marginal rate from what 36% to 39%, and we're called socialists for that. That was not the means of production. So all I'm saying is, the Democratic Party has moved significantly left of where Barack Obama was. Significantly left.
Oh yeah.
That's true. And the question is that where the actual political center of the country is right now?
And you see the argument?
They believe it is.
You see the debate we've started here? That's the debate we're going to have in 2020.
And that's probably the debate you want, isn't it?
And that's exactly right.
That's what I'm saying. I think that you want this.
And what Mark's bringing up, I mean, in mentioning socialism, I mean, on an academic level, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you're talking about means of production. But that's not, I think, that how it's perceived by most people. They identify and they see a lot of the policies that are being pushed. I mean, I looked at the political article that you were speaking about the other day, and this sort of litany of sort of fringe issues that was being advised that the Democrats need to stay away from if they are looking to be successful. They begin to lose credibility when you start stacking up all of these programs, the gigantic costs surrounding them, and people perceive that as being socialist. And it's no mistake that that's being invoked, and it's coming up again and again by both sides. And also, you know, the president focused on it when he did his announcement. They've tested that. They know that that's how people perceive it. They know that that's how it's being received, and they know that that's something that's going to be in play going on for the next 18 months.
So you think this plays into your favor? So let's stay on the economy. Let's not talk about the issues that I think Bill's right. He's referring to a piece by Charlie Sykes in Politico in which he's advising Democrats be careful on some of the issues he thinks are fringy. George Will has done the same thing. But on the subject of the economy, a couple of things. Under the Obama administration, under every presidential administration, there's this obsession with the unemployment rate. But the workforce participation rate's at a 40-year low. You got a lot of people not even trying to find work. So yes, that number is low, but how about the people who don't even count anymore? That is a big number of Americans. And Barack Obama did the same thing. They like this sleight of hand, look at the unemployment rate and where it's going, without talking about who's even trying to find work, who's given up. If you live in Youngstown, Ohio, have you given up on finding work? You may not even count. So yes, unemployment is low.
Or that's, upstate New York.
Upstate New York. Look, I picked Youngstown, Ohio. I'm from Northeast Ohio, but sure. No, you're right. The point is people feel forgotten. They're not even trying to find work.
In more ways than one, I'm right.
But they hear the political class saying, well, look at the unemployment rate. It's great. I don't think they feel counted. I think that's important enough. And I think you're going to see, if it's an Elizabeth Warren, less than it would be if it's Joe Biden or whoever it is, making that case that you keep telling us the economy is great. There's people who either aren't working, aren't trying to work, or if they're working, the wage gap is huge. And so is the economy that good, Bill?
I think that there's definitely segments of the society that are looking for improvement. As Mark pointed out, in upstate New York, we continue to struggle. And we are not the policies that are being brought forth by Governor Cuomo and what's been going on in Albany this past session have not turned to address this. There was a period of time where I think that people thought that there would be more attention brought on Western New York, or two times I can think of, when Hillary Clinton first ran for Senate, she spent a lot of time and a lot of effort saying Western New York, upstate New York, was going to be a focus of her attention. And then I don't think it actually happened. And, you know, in the initial rounds with regards to the focus of economic revitalization.
Gillibrand, too, by the way.
And that's correct. Yeah. And then also when, you know, we've had these economic development councils that have been trying to prime the pump and bring financial resources into these areas, I don't think that people see the net effect of that. I mean, it's money that's brought in the community that isn't getting, you know, we're not getting the bang for the buck. And I think that's...
Well, all truths tend to be simple. And Paul, jump in anytime you're ready. Yeah. But all truths tend to be simple. And the GDP, people thought it was an insane idea to see GDP growth in the 3 to 4% range. Well, GDP is the ultimate measure of the economy, whether it's growing. Now, your point is there are places that are hurting and there are people that are not getting work. And yes, that depends on where you are. Certainly in New York and upstate, you know, it's not good. And it's not good because we have policies, we have taxes, we have regulations like no other state in the United States. And so, yeah, there are places that are struggling because of that. But overall, is the economy growing? There is no argument to be made. It is.
But who's benefiting? The argument is not that the overall economy is growing in terms of the size of the pie. The argument is who's eating the pie. That's the argument.
Well, once you get out of New York State or get out of Massachusetts or get out of California, you do see it. That's why when you looked at the electoral map in 2016, you saw the small pockets of blue and so much red. The people that are living in states like Tennessee, a lot of the states are living much better. I'll give you a prime example. Someone moves that owns a $300,000 house here in Monroe County. They relocate to Tennessee. Their cost of living has just gone down, just on property tax, about $15,000 a year. That's $1,000 plus more in their pocket every month. So the good things that are happening, the increase in pay and other things, are having a much more positive effect away from here. Yes, you're hearing the Democratic candidates talk over and over, national candidates talk over and over. And like I said, they are right. If you're talking about someone, an unskilled person in New York City or Chicago or Detroit or Los Angeles.
It's not just the cities.
But that's where most of it is, though.
It's factory towns. It's the Rust Belt.
Right.
Right?
And
isn't it?
Well, I don't know, because we start seeing more and more jobs. I mean, seeing...
That's why Donald Trump won the Rust Belt. The Democrats fell asleep on
it. There's an opportunity for entrepreneurs again that there wasn't since 2008. And that is what... That's what America's about, and that's what we have to promote, you know, self-reliance and people doing it. And I think we see that now, those opportunities, and that might mean relocating to Tennessee if you want to start a business rather than staying here in New York. And we're seeing it with the exodus from the blue states. So, you're seeing the gentrification in New York City, but you get away from those areas, you're seeing mass exodus from these states.
Yeah, I mean, you've got an economic boom going on in Texas, and in a city like Austin, you know, it's got a high-tech cluster that's developing there. You have a lot of, you know, the low-regulatory, low-tax environment of Texas has helped fuel and stimulate that economy in a way that firms are moving operations from California into Texas. Austin is one of those communities where that's taking place. And the paradox is that you have a lot of people that are moving with their company into that community, and the city is turning bluer politically, but they're there because of the benefit that they're getting from Republicans running the state and the policies economically that have been brought forth by their leadership there for years, and yet they're coming in that community and they're remaining Democrats. Mm-hmm.
Now, you asked who is eating the pie?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's who's eating the pie. We're taxing people. We already know. We won't repeat it again here in the state of New York. We're taking people's money, hard-working people. We're taking their tax dollars at a rate that nobody's seeing anywhere in the country. We're giving it to who? Let's talk about the Photonics Center. Let's talk about 115 Canal Landing. Let's talk about the Biosciences Manufacturing Center. Let's talk about Mueller Yogurt. Let's talk about all these projects where... Quite frankly, and I can show it, contributors, also contractors, are getting big, big bucks to do these jobs.
Pay to play?
Pay to play. And then nothing happens. We just had one of your colleagues just did a story on 115 Canal Landing. They put millions into this building. They bought it. They were going to do a photovoltaic center. That went under. A couple of people got a few contributions out of that, but that thing went bust. Then they were going to do, that's the one where Joe Biden came to town. Big announcement, thousands of jobs. Here we go, right here, best facility in the country. Well, right now, the only people enjoying that are field mice and turkey because it's empty. There's grass growing. It's overgrown. And it's empty. But that's typical of what we're seeing. So who's eating the pie? Well, quite frankly, the taxpayer is paying for that pie through their taxes. It's being redistributed to contractors who are making big money. And this is going on all throughout the state. We already know about the Buffalo Billion and the arrests going on there and so on and so forth. And nothing gets done. It's just this big pay-to-play system, and that's who's eating the pie, and that's why New York is struggling.
So I want to ask all of our guests real briefly, and then we'll get to some listener feedback. Give me the candidate running on the Democratic side that you think could give the president, because let me just back up and say, the points about the GDP and the economy, very, very hard to overcome. When you have an incumbent in the White House and an economy with at least the fundamental numbers that look the way they do, it's a tough road. And I'm from Ohio originally. The president, I think he won Ohio by 11 points or something. I mean, it was massive. That was supposed to be a swing state. Having spent plenty of time in Ohio, it is hard to envision him getting beat in Ohio. I mean, the Democrats have a hard road in a lot of ways, but I'm curious to know who our guests think would be the most challenging, the candidate who could give them the most trouble, and the candidate who you'd love to see. And don't say Marianne Williamson, because she's not going
to
be nominated.
I'll tell you who it won't be, but I would love to see it, is Joe Biden. He's not going to make it.
Okay, but you would love that because you think Trump would beat him easily.
Yes.
Okay, who is the candidate who you think could give Trump the biggest...
I'm sure I won't get agreement here, but honestly, I've thought that from day one. She's a very talented individual. I know I may not agree with her positions, but she is a very talented lady. Kamala Harris.
Okay. Paul Simonelli.
I agree.
You do? That's interesting. Okay. So Kamala Harris, and Biden as well? You'd love to see Biden?
You mean assuming that I want Trump to get reelected?
Yes, I'm saying, who's the easy victory? Who's the easy victory?
I think that would be one of the easiest. He's not capable. He'll fold very quickly. He can't get past a single line. Yeah.
Joe Biden. Bill.
I think that the idea of Biden is the one that I have the most problem with, and think that he could be that, the concept that you've got a centrist Democrat that has experience both in the Senate, in the administration, that would be the one that gives me the most trouble. But I agree with Paul that in execution, he has a problem, you know, bringing it home and not tripping.
Well, you
over
saw the
himself.
Way he responded to Kamala Harris in the debate. The most obvious attack coming his way, he was not prepared for. It was pretty amazing.
Oi.
But anyway, so Joe Biden, and who you think would be a cakewalk?
I mean, there's such a wide number of people to choose from, but whether it's Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, I think that you've got a number of candidates that are prone to embrace all of the fringe problems that were brought up in the political article. And I think any one of those would be a cakewalk.
All right. So our guests talking about 2020 and what the Republicans are going to be focusing on, the issues that they think stand out to voters. And they're distilling it to an American economy that they think, all things considered, is better than often. Probably, I'm very confident saying they think the media underreports how well the economy is doing. So that's what we're talking about this
hour. I didn't say that.
Mark, I know you well enough. Mark Cassini, former Gatestown supervisor and CAO at American Rock Salt. Bill Napier is chair of the Monroe County Republican Party. And Paul Simonelli of counsel to the Wolford Law Firm with us in studio. We'll get some of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, the 2018 New York State Teacher of the Year joins us in studio. It's Christopher Albrecht, who has traveled a lot, talked to many students, parents, and teachers with that title. And Christopher was just one of five teachers across the country to be inducted into the National Teachers Hall of Fame. So we'll talk to him about that distinction, but also his thoughts on what he's been thinking about lately on improving education and opportunities for students next hour. This is Connections, and Mark Cassini was handing me a document saying, I know what's coming. Well, I'm going to read two comments from listeners on the subject of what's happening at the southern border and whether that is an issue. Joseph on Twitter, who works for the Simon School, and says the following. I was a Trump voter, and he's lost me, but I'm a New Yorker, so I guess that doesn't matter. For me, it was more of a shift within my priorities of what was important to me in a president. I started to place an emphasis on doing what I feel was right, as opposed to just voting with my wallet. The last straw was trying to meet the migrant caravan at the border with our military. That's from Joseph. Andrew emails to say, here's what Democrats don't understand. We like Trump's border control. We don't care if children are separated from their parents if it's because their parents are criminals. They shouldn't be there in the first place. And now we're supposed to just give them toothpaste and nice soaps? No way, Jose. From Andrew. Basically saying, people don't get it. What we're watching at the border, there are very different prisms through which people are seeing. I'll start with Bill. Is what's happening at the border a liability for the president? And are you personally troubled by what you see at the border?
I've been troubled at the fact that there's been unchecked border crossings going on for decades, and that we have failed as a nation to come up with policies and the resources necessary to secure our borders.
Okay. When it comes to what we see with kids, I mean, a lot of people are sharing the picture of the father and the child drowning there. Is that fair? I mean, are you concerned about that?
I'm concerned about it, but it's unfair to sit there and paint Donald Trump as being the person that's responsible for that. That policy was in place before he became president, and to say that it is his fault, that's not true.
I do want to say in response to that, I mean, I am not an expert on every administration's border policy. I certainly can say that having talked to people who are advocates for a much more progressive immigration policy, they were very displeased with the Obama administration. And, you know, there was this moment on Twitter where Jon Favreau, who wrote speeches for Barack Obama, posted this picture of you know, children and what he called cages, and it actually was from 2014.
Right.
So the policies, there are some similarities. My understanding, Bill, is that they've been strengthened and that the actual child separation is more aggressive, or that's where it is unique. You don't see anything unique that stands out to you as problematic.
Well, let me jump in
I
won't read the whole thing. Myth versus fact from the Department of Homeland Security. So the United States government has put this out. And believe it or not, the policies of Barack Obama and the policies of Donald Trump are very similar. There is not a whole bunch of difference. He has made it more public. He has put more resources into protecting the border, or as some would put it, preventing people from gaining asylum into the United States. But the truth is, it does bother me. I don't like seeing people lying face down trying to get to this country. But let's be honest about this. Again, not to repeat, but truth tends to be simple. Why is this happening? Number one, in Central America, the countries are failing. There is mass corruption. That's why it's just sending dollars down to, you know, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, those places is not going to help. We understand that, and very few policy wonks would disagree on that. So the Central America countries are failing. So people are leaving. They're leaving here for economic opportunity, and some are leaving fleeing violence. No question about it. And so we have to find a way to help those people who are fleeing violence, trying to gain asylum in the United States. We have an obligation to do that. We really, truly do. But we have to separate the wheat from the chaff. It's not fair. If you live in Uganda or Nigeria and you want to come to this country because you want the opportunity, the economic opportunity that exists here, why should you be put to the back of the line because you're from Nigeria or Uganda, where somebody who's coming from Guatemala jumps ahead of you? And again, I want to distinguish between asylum seekers and people who are looking for economic opportunity. Having said that, we have to find a way to address this. And even Democrats realize, and they didn't 6 months ago, that there is a crisis at the border and it has to be addressed. It truly does. It bothers me. It would bother anybody that has children, anybody with a soul or a heart, to see some of the things that are going on, and we have to fix it. But the other thing that's encouraging people to come here is when you tell in New York, hey, you want to come here, we'll take care of every one of your needs, whether it's health insurance, whether it's tuition, whether it's food, and you won't even have to worry about going through the immigration system. Just get here. And then we heard last night on the stage, we're going to make sure day one on our administration, everybody gets free health care that comes here, even if you come here illegally. And the other thing that was amazing, they said, and if you come here illegally, It's not illegal anymore. In other words, open borders. That just encourages a very bad situation to get much worse, and that's why we're seeing record apprehensions at the border and record number of peoples coming across. Do we have to fix it? Absolutely, and it should be a top priority.
Okay. Paul Simonelli.
I mourn for anybody that's died trying to get here, but I also mourn for the 3 million babies that are killed every year through abortion. I find it difficult to see the outrage by primarily on the left of what's going on in the southern border when they can endorse a policy that leads to the death of so many individuals. Saying that, if you look back on the people that are screaming the loudest right now, if you really look back 4 years, 6 years, or 8 years to public statements they made, you know, including the last president, these people were all very consistent with what the current president is trying to do. And no one was willing to do it. I mean, they were talking the talk, but they weren't willing to do it. So they talked the talk well. And the only reason there hasn't been anything, because it is such a positive issue for President Trump, that the Democrats just can't see their way clear to deal with. So they don't care that there's suffering going on in the border. They care about the political advantage they can gain from trying to make him look like a demon.
You don't think they actually care about those kids?
Absolutely not. I'm sorry, I'll be a cynic here for a moment. There's a political class, and the first rule of political class is to make sure you get reelected next time. And the way you do that is to raise money, and the way you do that is to get, you know, individuals and other folks to give you money. And so once you're encrusted into that piece of the system, and I give you a lot of credit for at least for the time being walking away from it, Mark, once you're in it and your whole life depends on it and your whole identity has to do with that, then yes, I think you become very selfish and worried about your own reelection only, and you'll do whatever you need to do that.
I actually, and with all respect, I disagree. I think both sides of the aisle care about this. I really do. I don't think any I shouldn't say anybody. There are very few people that don't have true feelings about this and want to see it improve. But it's just the approach. The question is, how do you solve this problem? And I think they're completely opposite on how they think they should solve it.
So here's what I think is fair. I think it's fair to point out that there was not nearly as much outrage when Barack Obama was president about
true.
What was happening at the southern border, about deportation, about treatment of kids and families. And under President Trump, that outrage has been cranked up. I think that is fair. I also wonder, though, if we can take a moment to look at a Trump administration lawyer arguing in court for the right to not give these kids toothbrushes and soap, and not fancy soaps. I mean, we're not talking about the kids who died. We're talking about the kids who were there. What, I don't get that.
I watched part of
that's
that.
That's what I don't get.
Right. I watched part of that oral argument, and what I took from that was that it's not up to the court to legislate the specific rules of how many times I have to be taken to a toilet daily. And once again, it's just the federal government overreaching. There's policies in place, and you know, it's up to the federal government or the court should not be legislating regulation. And I think that was more of what, if you watch the entire oral argument, that was the sense of what I saw, rather than, you know, the minute and a half that became popular.
Five and a half. But yeah, no. Look, Paul, you're right. You're right to say when we watch 5.5 minutes of an oral argument, we may not be getting the crux of it. But that attorney does seem to be making the case that you can't tell us that we've got to give these kids soap and toothbrushes. And that does seem a little ghoulish.
I think what the attorney was saying inartfully is that you shouldn't be telling us down to how many calories a day a person should be eating, the thickness of the mattress. That shouldn't be up to the courts to do that. And that's what I think, if once again, in the whole context of the argument that what is the role of the court in this, why are we even here?
So the bottom line is, do our guests here think that this issue is a problem for the GOP in 2020?
Just the opposite.
You think it's the opposite?
I think it's the opposite. I think you have another binary choice. You either solve this problem through the method on the far left, and that is open border society. No check at the border. We don't care who you are, what you're doing here, what your background is. It's either open borders or a nation of laws. Now, the humanitarian issue we have to address, but making an open border society is a very binary choice. You're going to get more of the same, especially in a portion of Central America where countries are failing. And quite frankly, we're seeing the results right here in Rochester. It always comes back locally. What am I talking about? We've had over a dozen murders here in the Rochester community, not 10 years ago, 20 years ago, recently. We had people like Andre McFarlane, who was deported 5 times, came back and killed 3 people. You had Efren Lopez Contreras, who was deported 2 times, killed a pastor's daughter on Christmas Eve. You had Alberto Reyes, who's now accused of murder of his estranged girlfriend, or his girlfriend and their child. And it goes on and on. It's Marlando Allen. There's a whole bunch of them.
But people who cross the border do not commit crimes at higher rates, Mark.
I am telling you, the problem is at the border. How can you be deported 5 times and find your way back here? That's the issue.
So this is an issue that this party feels is actually a winning issue, despite the noise that you hear.
How do you answer the question? How are you deported 5 times and find your way back here to kill 3 of our citizens in Rochester?
Oh, I'm not going to defend anyone in that situation.
I think even more locally and immediately. I mean, I worked for several members of Congress. They represented a large swath of agricultural area throughout Western New York. Immigration is a daily issue for the folks in those communities. We have a large detention facility you can see just off the thruway in Batavia. But just this past Tuesday, I don't think that it was insignificant what was going on with regards to the issue of driver's licenses for illegals in New York State with regards to the independence primary. And, you know, I listened to the clerk on this radio station and on this show. He was very inartful. He was trying to dance on the head of a pin. He wouldn't come down. I agree with Mark. It's a binary choice. You have 4 licenses for illegals or are you against it? He knows that, I know you don't like polls particularly well, but Siena shows that even in a deep blue state like New York, it is unpopular statewide. So that includes the environs of New York City. So when you come up into our region, it's even more unpopular, and it hurt him on Tuesday because he came off as being completely inauthentic, and that was one of his greatest assets at the end of the day. And it's one of those examples that it is an issue that's meaningful, and it is an issue that for Republicans is important, and it's going to help them
succeed.
Little
data from ICE, because I foiled ICE. You know me, I'm a nerd. Anyways, I foiled ICE, and in a 5-year period, we had over 47,000 arrests, and that was during the Obama administration, and that was not the most stringent enforcement policy put in place in the last 20 years. So we have a problem, and it's going to be a very binary choice. Either you believe in open borders and you're going to get more of the same, or a nation of laws. Dealing with the humanitarian issue is another story. We have to address that, but it's pretty binary.
When it comes to the election, being down to 7 states. One of our guests on Wednesday said it's about 7 states. It's not about the popular vote. It's about basically 7 out of 50 states will decide it. I'd like to know if you agree with that. And if you do, one of the things that our guests on Wednesday talked about was the idea that we are starting to see, especially Sanders and Warren, not necessarily all of the candidates, well, Pete Buttigieg, talk about the economy in a way that isn't about just left-right, but to workers generally speaking. That if you're a Republican or if you're someone who voted for Donald Trump and you're frustrated with the economy, here's why I think my views help you, as opposed to kind of just running left or running right. President Trump, I think, was pretty successful in the Rust Belt states at working that message for people who feel let down by the Democratic Party. So do you agree that we've got essentially 7 states, and is there a message, forget your own base, that's going to cross over and bring voters across to you?
The Democratic Party has a problem, because every one of the solutions, and even the individuals you're talking about, is more government spending. Bigger government, more expensive government, and that ain't going to fly with anybody. It's the old problem. When you hit the economic curve and you go negative on OPM, that's an issue, and people realize that. Other people's money. So that's going to be a problem for them.
And do you agree that it's a 7-state election, essentially?
Yes.
Okay, Paul Simonelli.
Sure. I agree on the 7 states, and what Mark said, I have to agree with also. It's just where people are doing better, the Democrats are only offering, on a national level, are only offering taking away what's allowing them to do better, more money out of their pocket, and not seeing any immediate return for it. So I think if things keep going the way they are, I think this is a done deal already.
You keep going farther left, there's a consequence to that. There really truly is. You continue to go further to the left, the American people are going to reject it.
I agree. It's probably seven states. Which seven states those are is a fluid. Question. I've worked on several presidential campaigns. Daily we get what was the battleground state update, and it would shift around a little bit. There's a couple that are fairly consistent, Ohio, Florida, but there it depends on the issues and what's going to make which states those battlegrounds. And if it's like gun control, I mean, you've got states like Pennsylvania, Florida, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan are all going to be, those are net positive gains for Republicans if that becomes a big issue. And if it's court packing, I think that that's similarly going to be a gain in those same areas. It just depends on what the issue matrix looks like when you look into the final weeks of the November election and what were really the key issues going on. Shift those issues a little bit, and you might have a different mix of which states.
Right. Okay. Linda in Penfield on the phone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, everyone. First thing I'd like to say is that I do want to acknowledge that the three gentlemen are definitely seeing the humanitarian crisis, and I appreciate that. And I want to speak to the issue of government control and government spending, and that it is an investment. And I will tell you why. My dad was laid off from a factory job. He was a veteran. And when he was laid off, he had to go on welfare, and he was 52 years old, and it was humiliating for him, and he hated to do it, and he did it. And we did not come from a family of means. I am a first-generation college graduate from the state system, SUNY Geneseo and UB. And I also want to add that because my dad was a veteran, my mom was eligible for aid and attendance benefits, which paid for her to be at Monroe Community Hospital, which, again, is government-run. And so I want the gentleman to keep in mind that we aren't all moochers, right? And it's not just because I come from the neighborhood that I came from. There's a lot of hardworking people who need the government support so they can become self-reliant. And believe me, my dad took jobs that were minimum wage, okay, and he had trouble getting medicine for his COPD because of it. So I just want the gentleman to keep that in mind, right, and Linda, I think that's all I have to say.
Linda, thanks for the phone call.
And
thank you, Linda.
My comment on that would be if we were just taking care of the people that really needed something, there would be a lot more money to do that than when we create programs where we create generations of dependency with people. I agree completely with her. There's always going to be people with need. Right. I'm a veteran. I've benefited from some of those great veterans' benefits, and I will the rest of my life. And hopefully, you know, if I need it, I'll have that aid in attendance also someday. I have no problem with that. But when we create programs and create dependency where there's this, where there is so much spending, I don't know, you could tell us what percentage of the county budget goes to mandates.
It's close to 90%.
Yeah. And so when you start looking at 90% of it spoken for before you even figuring out what roads need to be fixed, what special programs with people with needs are, just that's where we run into a problem.
Linda, thank you for calling, and we're all grateful for your father's service, and we wish you all the best. And I for one believe in safety nets. I've supported programs that help people that are most vulnerable in our society, and I will continue to do so outside of politics. But I've got to tell you that the big problem, as Paul pointed out, and I'm sure Bill will point out, when you start taxing people, taking money from them, and redistributing it to companies who go in and do these do-nothing projects, we've spent billions in this state, billions. I forgot what the number is now. It's well over $18 billion. Somebody can go look it up. putting money into projects like the Buffalo Billion, like Photonics.
So you don't want to imagine Monroe and Comita to be doing tax breaks or tax deals either?
I think when you have a project which is on the bubble, and we could potentially reduce some of the taxes, but this just throwing $500 million.
Because you're going
to
the state, which is run by Democrats, but you could go to the county, which is run by Republicans.
No, I'm not a big fan. Here's the reality. It's this self-fulfilling prophecy. You keep taking taxes from people for projects that are do-nothing projects, and then unfortunately, what does that do? It raises the taxes, whether it's, as I said, Photonics, which is a big beef with mine, or whether it's some of the other projects, Mueller Yogurt, whether it's the Buffalo Billion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, GE out in the Albany area. You can go on and on and on. That's wrong. You can't do that.
All right, last quick question. I'm going to direct it to Bill, and I got to keep it super tight. But I never had a Democrat get upset if I asked if they supported Barack Obama. Rich Funke was annoyed with me for asking if he supports the president, didn't want to talk about it. Cheryl DeNolfo dodged that question on a primary election night when our colleague Veronica Volk asked her. If the president is doing as well as you say, why are Republicans upset if we ask if they support him?
The president nationally is doing very well, and I think that his policies are very strong. But, you know, he is very unpopular in New York State, and there's no doubt about that. And we have our challenges as a party in communicating to the folks in New York State all the positive aspects and what they're benefiting from the Trump administration.
Okay, fair enough. I appreciate the answer. And I appreciate the time with Bill Napier, the new Republican Party chair from Monroe County. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Let's talk
some more. Paul Simonelli of Counsel to the Wolford Law Firm. Thank you, Paul. And Mark Cassini, who's the CAO at American Rock Salt. Thank you, Mark. Short break. More Connections coming up.